Blog Talk Radio.
We need more linear thinking at this point. Oh, yes. Does that mean that we forget the intuition? Not at all. Does that mean we forget the oral tradition? Not at all. But it means then that while maintaining those traditions, we also must enhance other aspects of our personality. We want to look a bit at culture. What is culture? And we should ask this again. I admire Chancellor Williams very much. And I think the destruction of black civilization, of course, was a magnificent book. And I've said many times, though, I think many people read it incorrectly. They read it as history, which it really is not, per se. It is, as he stated very clearly, a set of case studies and analysis of African culture with and of African history with the question in mind, in what way did these cultures or this history advance our interests in as a people, and in what way did this history fail us as a people as well? And we have to look at it that way. What were the problems represented by African cultures such that we permitted ourselves to be overrun by Europeans and we find ourselves in the situation that we find ourselves tonight? Understand? It's no insult for us to ask that question of ourselves. And it's no insult for us to look critically at African history and culture and to be critical of it. It is only through our being critical of our history and our culture that we can advance our interests as a people and survive as a people. Looking at the question, what is culture? Horton and Hunt said, from their life experiences, a group develops a set of rules and procedures for meeting their needs. The set of rules and procedures together with a supporting set of ideas and values is called a culture. To a great extent, you see, a culture involves a set of rules and a procedure for meeting needs. And this is the thing we have to keep in mind. You don't have a culture just to have a culture. And you don't claim a culture just because it's a culture or just because it's African. The ultimate thing that culture must do is solve problems. That's why people evolve a culture. That's why a culture comes into existence as a way of what? Solving problems and meeting needs. That's why, at a certain point, when a culture no longer meets the needs of a people or solves the problem confronting a people, that culture must be transformed. There's nothing sacred about holding a culture in the face of, you know, new events and new changes. Unless, of course, you're free to do that if you're willing also to accept suicide or death. And you have that right to that choice. You know, I tell people, you know, we have the right to say, look, we're going to hold on to this culture even if it kills us. But we should be what? Very conscious of our decision. We should not be holding on to it out of a misunderstanding of what culture is supposed to do. Ultimately, culture is supposed to solve problems and to meet the needs of the people. And a culture then has to be measured against those standards. Does this culture meet our needs? Does it solve our problems? Chancellor Williams, in a sense, then looked at the African cultures, looked at African characteristics, and looked at them in terms of in what way did they meet our needs and in what way did they deal with the slave trade and colonialism and the other kind of things that happened to us as African people. And after going through that, then he set up what? The plan, which a lot of people don't read, which is the whole point of what? It's the whole point of the book. Not the first part, but really the second part. Looking at our culture and our history critically, he then, and looking at our situation and where we are today as a result of that history and of those cultures, he then draws out a map for a plan, a way for us to what? get out of our situation and to restore African civilization and to restore African people. But it's at that point most people sort of move on to something else. Mm-mm. This is the place you must study. We're going to include that in our power studies, by the way, that plan along with some others. The sets and rules and procedures together with a supporting set of ideas. Cultures are not just ways people sing and dance and what they eat and how they dress and the rituals and so forth that they perform. These ways of behaving and dressing and so forth are based on sets of ideas and values. And ultimately, in a deeper sense, it's this set of ideas and values that lay the basis for culture. Kluckhorn, an anthropologist, indicated that culture he defined culture as all the historically created designs for living, explicit and implicit, rational, irrational, and non-rational, which may exist at any given time as potential guides for the behavior of man, for the behavior of the people. In other words, culture creates designs as a result of its history for living and provides guides for its members, guides for behaving. As a set of the guides for designing, for guiding the behavior of its members, a culture provides standards of proper cognitive, emotional, and behavioral conduct. Culture provides a set of norms and concepts of what is to be expected to exist, why we expect them to exist. Though culture is a product of actual experience, culture is essentially ideological, meaning that it essentially exists in the mind, because culture ultimately is based on the sharing of beliefs and customs and expectations. We receive our culture as a result of, as a part of our social heritage. To the degree that the individual identifies or is at one with this culture, and to the degree to which the members of a culture identify with it, culture is represented in the minds of its people. In other words, we have to recognize deeply that culture cannot exist outside of ourselves. It only can exist in our minds and in our bodies as a people. And therefore, to a great extent, it is ideological, more than it is physical, more than it is behavioral, more than it is just ways of dressing. Ultimately, a culture must be represented in the very minds of a people. And it is only through its representation as a mental entity that a people can identify with the culture. A culture is a way of thinking, a way of attending the world, of perceiving the world, of classifying and categorizing the world, of ordering the world, of processing information, and of evaluating the world. When we say then that the Europeans decultured us or distorted our culture, we are also saying then that the Europeans have distorted our modes of attending the world, our modes of experiencing the world, our modes of classifying and categorizing the world, our modes of processing information that comes from the world. So there's no little wonder then that we are having problems in what some people call education, particularly as it is Eurocentrically designed, that our children are perceived as having problems in thinking skills and math skills and science skills and so forth. Because ultimately, you see, culture provides you with a frame for thinking. It provides you with a structure for organizing information, for classifying information, for evaluating information, you see, for processing information. And when you distort a people's culture, then you distort their capacity to appropriately organize information and deal with it. And this is what has happened to us. This is the reason why I say again and again that the problem of education in terms of the problems our children have in schools are not education problems. They are political. They only express themselves as educational problems. The problems our children may have in paying attention, thinking so-called logically, categorizing, classifying, in terms of vocabulary and so forth, are really not academic problems. They are cultural problems, and they are the result of political interactions. Because in transforming our sense of who we are and what we are, and in transforming our culture, so was our thinking and so forth transformed as well. This is why ultimately the educational problems of our people will have to be solved in terms of cultural transformation, not just in terms of educational technique, you see. And this is what the whites try to lay on us. You know, we're going to discover finally that great reading technique. Children can learn almost in any way you teach them. But it's about more than technique. It must be a part of a total cultural structure. And the children must come with a cultural intentionality, because no technique is going to matter if they pay no mind, if they have no interest. You see, if their culture has given them little or no reason for learning what is to be taught, if what they're learning is really not relevant to their situation and their circumstances. And so we have to understand very much how culture itself structures the thought processes. Now, there are some of you who are saying, but there are those of us who knew nothing about African culture and we got all A's in school and so forth and so on. Remember this, though. We got these A's in school and we went through these schools at the price of alienation. The gentleman who's Carter G. Woodson wrote about the fact that it took him, 30 years to get over that Eurocentric education. What is he talking about? To a degree, without that African-centeredness, without that African sense of culture, without an African-centered intentionality that determined why he was learning and for what reason he was learning and how he was going to use his learning in the interests of African people, he adopted an alien culture, as many educated blacks have had to do. In adopting the alien culture and adopting the alien outlook and adopting alien values and so forth, they adopted then a thought framework, you see, that allowed so-called what? Success within the European academic system, you see. But the unfortunate thing about it is, once you adopt that structure and that mode and orientation of thinking, you can only work within it. And so you can keep your ability to think abstractly and logically and scientifically only if you work for us as a what? As a scientist. But you cannot take that thought and what? Outside of that structure and use it in your own interest. And this is the dilemma that many of those who so-called succeeded in this system have had to face, you see. I categorize and I classify, but I categorize and I classify in terms of European structures, and I find that I'm only comfortable in what? Working within those structures, and I can only what? Advance those structures. The European system has this economic system set up in such a way that when you try to use this structured kind of thought outside of the system, it won't pay you. Yeah, it will punish you. And often your own group has problems with it, because our group only pays preachers. But it would rarely pay anyone else that tries to operate in its interest. And so you get caught up in two worlds. Socially, culture patterns the ways in which its members relate to each other, interact with each other, perceive each other, and the ways they organize, develop, institutionalize, and apply their human potential in order to adapt to the conditions in which they live to satisfy psychological and social survival needs. Ultimately, as I said again and again, culture is about solving problems. But we're going to learn, as I've indicated before, solving problems in a cultural way, creating power in a cultural way, requires relating to each other in a particular sort of way. Implies interacting with each other in a particular sort of way and perceiving each other in a particular sort of way. I've indicated under other circumstances that individuals do not have power. Power is the result of the nature of social relations between people. The way people choose to interact with each other makes power. If you don't believe it, you can go back a few years and see how little white boys could order grown black men around. Were they big enough to beat them? Were they big enough? Did they have enough power to knock them down? No, they didn't. But it was because those little white kids were in a, what, structured framework and had behind them, what, a set of structures and strategies that because white people had chosen to relate to each other in a particular way and interact with each other in a particular way and interact with us in a particular way, even a white child could come out and express power over black folk. But the power was not what? Inherent in the child. But it was inherent in the culture and inherent in how that culture was designed and structured. And it's out of this, and this is what I've told you before about an economic system. An economic system is not the mere existence of money. Economic systems existed prior to money. Money as an instrument of economy has come late in the history of man. And yet we've had economies for hundreds and thousands of years before money came into existence. So ultimately then, an economy must have something to do with the way people choose to cooperate with each other and relate to each other. It is out of this that an economy develops, and it's out of this that power develops, you see. So if you have a culture, the culture is going to provide patterns of relating and interacting. It's these patterns of relating and interacting that permits a people who belong to a culture to solve the problems that confront them. So you see, again, it's just not something is just to indicate that you wear, you see, or the speech that you make, you see. It ultimately has to be about relating in a particular structured sort of way. This is what culture is socially. It is very important to keep in mind that a culture is, to a significant extent, a historical product. Let's talk a second about identity. Identity is the social and personal outcome of the or product of an identification process. According to Bandura, this identification process is a process in which new responses are acquired and existing repertoires of behaviors are modified to some extent as a result of subjection to direct or indirect conditioning procedures. All cultures condition the people that belong to them. All cultures ultimately must have some means of rewarding and punishing behavior. And that's another thing we don't want to face, you know. We want everybody to do right just because it means doing right. And this is what I said earlier when we talk about these conspiracies and these boule. You're not going to win this game if you don't have a means of neutralizing people and rewarding people, you see, and controlling people. The reason why, as I've often said, the very first thing that we must do if we are to transform our children is to get control of them. Yeah. And we must become their primary rewarders and punishers. We must determine the conditions under which they are socialized if we want to create the kinds of people we need to solve our problems. You are not going to solve your problems giving the control of your children over to other people. And yet we sit around here hoping every day, after pushing our children and ourselves into the faces of white folk, into the faces of our enemies, that these people by luck or some means will happen to be the kind of people we need for ourselves. The very point and process of education is to create the people you need for your benefit. And if a culture is going to educate your children, it then will educate them to benefit whom? Itself, not you. Not you. You must bring your children under your own control, and you must be in control of the conditioning process. This is what it's about. If you don't have control of that, then really you're not going to have control of the children. Because identification with a culture, becoming cultured or enculturated, is the result of a culture approving and disapproving, of rewarding and not rewarding, and of sometimes even punishing, to ultimately shape the individual in a way that it benefits the culture and ultimately the individual, him or herself. And this is what identity is about. It's about patterning, the patterning of thoughts, feelings, and actions after other persons who serve as models. You even learn to love. You know, we think that love is something natural, just flows out of us automatically. And yet we have a number of cultures who did not base marriage and these other things, as I've told you before, on romantic love. Mm-mm. Even romantic love is taught and learned. Yeah. Yeah. People are taught how to feel. And we do it all the time. You shouldn't feel that way. You should feel ashamed of yourself for thinking this way, for behaving this way. And we're so unconscious, we don't even recognize it, you see. But we are doing what? We are dictating what? Feelings, thoughts, emotions. What is love? The kids hear it all day long in their records, right? The chill run up my spine. I can't get him out of my mind. I can't eat. I can't sleep. I can't... But all this is what? Defining what? This is the way you feel if you're in what? If you're in love, you see. And when you got that feeling, then you can do some other things. You know, and you can, you know, make all kind of commitments based on that. But many cultures have built marriage and family and other things on different modes of thinking and behavior other than that. And when you study the history of romantic love, when this type of love approach and this type of approach for building families and so forth first started coming up, there were many people who thought it was just a sign of madness, a sickness, of a precarious basis upon which to build family and culture, you see. But what we're trying to illustrate here is that culture, to a good extent through its conditioning process and other processes, through providing models, helps people to pattern their ways of thinking and feeling and behaving and pattern attitudes. Both the conditioning procedures and contingencies and the models are provided by culture. And of course, we recognize that that's one of our major problems today, that often the models that we want to exhibit before ourselves and our children, and often the means by which we can reward our children's behavior, have not been placed in our hands. That another culture has control of the conditioning mechanism and has control of the models that our by which our children are socialized. We must recognize again then, if we are serious about enculturating our people and enculturating our children, then we must gain the means by which we have to condition their enculturation. We must gain the capacity to reward, to punish, and to reinforce, to model the kind of behavior for our children and ourselves that we need to model. Identity is achieved when, as a result of having undergone the identification process, the individual comes to perceive himself as possessing a distinct and unique character or personality, as being a person in his own right, as being able to answer the questions to his own satisfaction, who am I? What am I, and what do I do with my life? Identity, to the extent that it is a cultural product And identity is a cultural product. And I want to emphasize this because, you see, in this society, we stress individualism. Mm-hmm. And I try to get across to people all the time that in reality there's no such thing as an individual. That is a social fiction. It is a type of label we use, but it does not exist in reality. That the individual, the thing that we call an individual, is really a synthesis of social experience, a unique combination of our having interacted with others and having undergone social experiences, and it's our unique way of expressing our social relations and our experiences. But who we are and what we are is the result of social relations. It is not something that is completely what? Unique to us and not shared on some level with others. The very fact that you speak a language means that you have a shared identity on some level. If you were completely individual, no one would be able to understand what you were saying. You see? You cannot fit into what? An ordered system and in an ordered society. If you want to imagine to be, you can be a complete individual if you are in space all by yourself. But then what would be the point? It would have no what? No meaning. It would be pointless. Even the concept of individual can only achieve its definition within a social structure. It only has meaning within a social structure and within in terms of relating socially to someone else. Otherwise, it is pointless. It is the social that creates the individual, not the other way around. And yet those who rule over us, you see, will have us think that we can be individuals in and of ourselves and by ourselves without any connection whatsoever to anyone else. And in that way, of course, it can maintain the disunity of our culture and maintain our disunity as a people and ultimately destroy us as a people. So identity is a cultural product. It is the incarnation of a cultural ideology, ecology, and of cultural practice. Identity is culture made flesh. Identity is an instrument for the expression of cultural power. Yes. When an individual identifies with a culture, and remember we said culture is ultimately contained what? In us, then the individual becomes the what? Instrument of that culture, you see. And this is what I tried to tell you some lectures ago when I talked about manhood, right? When I told you that manhood is a social definition, and to be a man is to be socially defined, so that in expressing what it means to be a man, in defending one's manhood, one also does what? Expresses one's culture and defends what? The culture. And in defending the honor of one's manhood, one defends what? The honor of the culture and the honor of the people. And therefore, ultimately, manhood is an expression of the culture, not of a chauvinistic wish on the part of a male. It is not to be defined in isolation and detached from the needs of the culture itself. That when manhood becomes defined, detached from the needs of the culture itself, detached from the needs of people itself, when boys are not trained into men relative to the culture, then these boys will prey upon the culture and destroy the culture. And this is a part of what we have in so-called black-on-black violence. Boys who've been bought into manhood in ways that are detached from African culture and African people. You see, who have not engaged in training in an organic relationship to their Africanness. And therefore, since they are not socially defined, they then become antisocial in their behavior. So ultimately, you see, an identity and a personality is a cultural instrument, and it is through this identity and through this personality that the culture expresses itself, and the culture is perpetuated, and the culture has an impact on the world, and the culture expresses itself as power and defends itself as a culture. But if it defends itself as a culture, it defends its members as people as well. You see? But when people are detached from a culture, they stand alone. And they are undefended. They become vulnerable. And others now destroy them one by one, here and there. And ultimately, a whole of a people are wiped out. Thus, identity, self-concept, are products and instrumentalities as much, if not more, political, economic entities than social, psychological entities. What am I saying here again? We're used to seeing identity as a psychological concept. You see, we talk about my identity as if it belongs to what? Me only. You see, my personality, my this. No, no. Ultimately, we must recognize that our personalities and our identities are, to a good extent, instrumentalities for our culture. But the thing that we want to recognize more so than this is that identity, self-concept, what we call the self and personality, are as much political and economic entities as they are social and psychological entities. In other words, identity, even in a diffused state, is a political economy, an organization of interests, tastes, desires, passions, ideals, motives, values, etc., the pursuit of and the satisfaction of which maintains social power relations, social prerogatives, the integrity of the social, political, economic system, the cultural status quo. What am I saying here? The culture, in inculcating particular values in people, in inculcating particular desires in people, and they don't, see, the culture doesn't inculcate into you the desire for what? Everything, does it? No, it says what? You should desire this and not that. This is desirable, but this is horrible, you know. This you should be interested in, that you don't have to worry about, you see. This you should feel strongly about, that you shouldn't have to worry about, you see. This you should strive to be. These are the ideals we wish you would actualize. This you don't have to try to strive to be. As a matter of fact, you can reject this. This is where you should try to go. These are the goals that we approve of. The others, we don't. Now, when a culture then organizes these values, these ideals, these interests, and so forth, this is a part of our cultural identity, such that when you pursue the satisfaction of these desires, when you pursue the actualization of the cultural ideals, when you pursue the interest that the culture has inculcated in you, what do you do then? By doing this, you maintain what? The culture itself. You see? And many of those things are political, and many are economic. In other words, if a culture tells you that eating a certain food is the right thing to do, and this is what we're about, and eating this food is central and important to our culture, then believe it or not, there's going to be a system of production to do what? Produce what? That food. A system of what? Distribution as well, you see. And a whole system of economic what? Relations. You see. So therefore, this taste, even the taste for food, or certain interests, when you pursue them, maintain a social system and maintain an economic system. And if the structure of that culture, if it's a class culture, a class structure, and if that structure is built on wealth, and the accumulation of wealth, and the control of the means of production by certain people, Your pursuit of those cultural tastes helps to maintain the structure of that culture. Am I getting through? Am I putting you to sleep? Hang in with me. Hang in with me, please. Okay. It's very important that we get this in mind. Because without this theory and understanding this, you're going to go blindly into the training of young boys and the training of your young girls. You're going to take them through the rituals and everything, but they're going to still have European taste and European desire, European things. And they still pursue European ideals and all that, even with their kente on. And despite them, and their superficial behavior, if those tastes and interests and passions and so forth are not also transformed in particular directions, despite their superficial attachment to African culture, they will continue to perpetuate their oppression and maintain the system that they think they're trying to get out from, you see? And this is why you have to understand this theoretical thing so that you know where you're going when you're talking about educating these children African-centrically, you see. This is why you ultimately are going to have to reject multiculturalism and understand that it's African-centeredness that must be taught to our children, not multiculturalism. Multiculturalism says, all right, everybody's culture is okay, you know, Pollyanna. Oh, you got a culture, I got a culture, all God's children got a culture. So, you know, it's all right. You can taste from this one. You can taste from that one. You buy from this one. You buy from that one. Oh, which is exactly what black folk are doing right now. You see? And therefore what? Keeping other people's families alive. Keeping them out of crime. Keeping them well housed. You know, and all the things we're doing because we have not controlled our what? Taste and interest and evolved them in ways that they advance our culture and us as a people. Please get rid of multiculturalism. And it makes you believe every culture is all right. Here you are suffering from European culture, and now you're going to, you know, it's all right. You can't put one down and put the other one up. I mean, Europeans amuse me anyway, talking about their cultural traditions and what great traditions they have brought to the world. The tradition is what you do. Yeah, and it's an insult as an African man to have Europeans talk about their great tradition.
That's right.
You may talk about your philosophy, but that's not your tradition. You may talk about your religion, but that's not your tradition. Or if it is your tradition, then no matter how beautiful it sounds, I must reject it because it enslaved me. It oppressed me and the whole bit, you see. So, and I don't care how sweet it sounds and how logically it is put together or how literate it may be. The ultimate thing is, in what way does it express itself in relationship to me and my people? And if this is the outcome of European tradition, then that tradition must be rejected. You must understand, ladies and gentlemen, what Europeans call great tradition goes hand in hand with their capacity to kill. You know, the Germans, I couldn't understand. You know, we were the literary people and we were the, you know, this and that. But that's one of the reasons why you were able to kill the way you did. Because that was also in there as well. You look at Elijah Muhammad, a misunderstood person. Yeah, misunderstood. Because again, sometimes we're so right-brained. We let our dislike or disapproval of certain of his behaviors overshadow our capacity to see what gifts he brought us as a people and to come to really understand what this man was about and the greatness of what he created in the Nation of Islam. Yeah. Because we let a series of events get to us so much, we want to throw the baby out with the washwater. You see. But what was he doing? He recognized, too, that cultural identity, religious identity, were as political as they were psychological, were as economical as they were psychological, you see. And he recognized then that he had to also change the taste of black people and change their what? Interest as well. Their emotions and their what? Feelings as well. And a part of that change was projection of the white man is demon mythology, which was very functional and real. But very functional. See, I've told you, a lot of people think, oh, well, that wasn't the truth. This wasn't the point. It wasn't the point. It amazes me now. You know, somebody mentioned the Tuskegee experiments. These whites are going to tell all the truth now. Now that they got the what? The world, what? Wrapped up. But in wrapping it up, they projected the what? The myth. Because the myth, the major function of the myth is to organize people, to organize a people's perception of themselves, to give them a sense of destiny and commonality, to arrange their social relations in such a way so that they could achieve particular points and particular ends. And it's not that they didn't know that the Egyptians might have been African. It was in their literature. That's a lot of where we got it from, isn't it? But at the point where a mythology of Africans as being uncultured served to organize them and create a unity among themselves and served to create a set of relations that permitted them to make a conquest of the globe, they projected that mythology. And it was a powerful one. Now that they think they have it made, they say, well, yeah, you were Egyptians, weren't you? Oh, yeah, we did give you TB down there. You know, what are you going to do about it? Oh, now we're becoming honest folk. You know, but what happened? No banks are changing hands. No means and ownership of production are changing hands. No real control of your destiny is changing hands. But you're multicultural now. We have greater understanding and truth. Mm-mm. You've got to go deeper than that. You got to do more than tell the truth. You're going to reparate yourself. We're going to take these reparations from you. You can admit we're Egyptians if you want to, but it's not the end of it. Mm-mm. No way. And we as black people can't fall for the okie doke. Oh, they say we're Egyptian. Ain't that wonderful? Oh, they're saying that we're this and we're that. Isn't that nice? Uh-uh. Now, you see, because now we're moving toward multiculturalism, right? Suddenly we're going to see them all as nice and sweet and wonderful. But what? The actual power relations that run the world. In order for us to be in the state that we're in today as people, we have to be out of our minds. We literally have to be crazy. It is necessary for us to be crazy. It is necessary for us to be backwards. It is necessary for us to be maladjusted. It is necessary for us to be disunited. It is necessary for us to be self-hating. It is necessary for us to be filled with an inferiority complex. In a world where the European is essentially about 10% of the world's population, if that 10% is to continue to rule over the other 90%, it must keep that 90% out of its mind. It must keep that 90% in a state of deception. It must keep that 90% filled with a feeling of powerlessness and incompetence. If this 10% is to continue to consume more than 60% of the world's resources, if this 10% is to continue to rob African, Asian, and other nations of their material wealth, then it must keep those people in a state of maladjustment. And this implies then that no matter how much integration you may bring about, the feeling of inferiority must be a constant in the black personality. No matter how many people you run for president, no matter how many mayors you get elected, no matter how many people you get on the board of IBM and the others, the basic sense of inferiority, the basic sense of dependency must remain a constant in the black mind. And I will indicate this, and I think this study, which occurred now some 40 years later, shows this to be the case. Dr. Clark shows surprise that after all of this time, this feeling is still there. I would not, and I don't think any student who's basically looked at the necessity of black people being out of their minds as being the foundation of European dominance would not be surprised. I think it was quite predictable. Remember, these children have this feeling of inferiority basically from the end of their second years. You can pick up this sense of inferiority as early as three and a half years old. So it starts very early. And I'm still working through my mind the implications of that finding. We are talking about preschool children, not only children that are in school, but children who are having this feeling prior to school. This would, of course, indicate that to a degree that our environment is saturated with racism through TV, through the various media, through the pictures our parents have on the walls, through the unconscious and conscious state the child's behavior and attitude starting in the womb itself. And I often start my developmental classes not with the prenatal period and how egg meets sperm, but with why do you have children in the first place? Because the reasons you have children will influence their development. It will influence them from the time they're in your womb until, of course, the day they die upon this earth. It would indicate then that to a degree and in some way the black community itself has been induced in helping to bring about a feeling of inferiority in its children. To a good extent, it is not so much the actions of racism that destroy us, the discrimination by white folk and Europeans, the kind of hatred that they express toward us as people that destroys us and gives us an inferiority complex. It is to a good degree how we as people react to these actions. Whether we believe the propaganda or not, whether we believe what the European actually has said, we cannot often control the behavior of other people. But we do have a greater control over how we react to that behavior. And to a good extent, the challenge of an Afrocentric education is to educate us in our tendencies to react. To a good extent, it would mean that the actions of racism apparently have induced some of us to accept racist propaganda and to really believe it, to internalize it. Once we internalize the propaganda, then we become social agents for the racists themselves. And to a good extent, then, the black family, once it internalizes the propaganda of Eurocentric racist, becomes a social agent for the racist and begins to produce the kinds of children that the racists want from the time of conception onward. It becomes instructive, you see, to look at a family not as something that just raises children, but a family to a good extent is the social agent of the society. It produces the kinds of children that the society says it needs and wants. The family looks out at the opportunity structure, at its own social position. It looks out at what it views as the future for its children, for its group, for its nation, and it inculcates those views into its children and rears its children in terms of those views, sometimes consciously and sometimes unconsciously. And in that way, it begins to create the children for the society. In a heavily segregated society, for instance, if your black boy or girl would have said some years ago that they wanted to be president of the United States or that they were going to be president of the United States, How many of us, by being realistic, would have discouraged that view? You know, ain't no black man going to be this or no black woman going to be that. Be real. And in the service of being real, by saying, well, I don't want him to be disappointed. I want to save him from racism and save him from the recognition one day that there are limitations to his aspirations. We quietly steer them toward a trade or a skill. Get this and get a job. So you, what's happening there? While it may have a realistic basis in a certain sort of way, you are also at the same time, though, creating the child's aspirations. You're also creating the child's motivations. You're creating the child's view of itself in line with the way the society is structured. A true Afrocentric family not only relates to his children in terms of reality, but it relates to his children in terms of idealism. It relates in the sense that there is a world that it is an African family and we as an African people want to bring about. While the black man may not be president of the United States, it does not mean that he cannot rule the world. The true Afrocentric family then not only raises his children in terms of the so-called social realities, because it recognizes that social realities are things that men create themselves. And therefore it raises children to create a reality suitable to the advancement and development of black people. But an unconscious black family, an unconscious people, a people who've fallen victim to racism, a people who've fallen victim to a sense of inferiority, then will produce the kind of inferior children that the white society needs to continue its dominance in the world. And in this way, then, the black family and the black community and black leadership becomes allied with the dominant group and with the Eurocentric group. It is this kind of thing that we must come to become conscious of and to defeat consciously. I'm going to give you a little taste of what I'm writing about in my current book. I want to indicate that black maladjustment is not just a suffering in the soul of black people. It's not just a feeling of inferiority in which over which the individual has to get. It's not just a feeling of alienation that you get over by going to a therapist, that you get over by attending various therapeutic sessions. Black maladjustment is functionally necessary for the world as it is currently constituted. Black maladjustment is a political factor, and I often try to get across to people the understanding that when we go to these universities and these schools, one of the greatest deceptions that's run upon us is the idea that the things that we are taught in these schools are non-political, that they are neutral, that they are somehow universal. And of course, the whites run a beautiful game on us when they, for instance, name their courses without putting their ethnicity in front of them. They don't say white psychology, white education, white economics, white physics, white chemistry, you know. And we often naively then assume because they're called economics, psychology, anthropology, that means we are in a course that has general and universal meanings. And we are made to think that we are odd when we call a course black studies, that there's something wrong with it. But every course in the American college and university and in the American educational establishment is a course in white studies, ladies and gentlemen. And every course in every discipline is designed for essentially the same thing, to maintain white dominance. We must be very conscious of that, and we must recognize that a major part of the education of our children and of ourselves is the fact that we have to politicize the courses that we're taking, even science, even physics and chemistry.
So a lot of people think, well, you know, we're talking about atoms and molecules and this and that, and they have no ethnicity and they have no politics. On the fundamental, in a fundamental way, you may be right, but on another level, there's a problem with that. Science, scientific thinking and technological development does not just develop in the head of some genius. It's not the result of some scientific genius who happened to strike upon some major discovery. Scientific discovery and technological development take place within a political social structure. You have to have a political system, a system of social relations, an economic system in order that science and technology develop and flourish. They do not flourish in a vacuum. Therefore, it is not enough just to teach your children physics and chemistry. You must teach them the politics of physics and chemistry. You must teach them the economics of physics and chemistry. You must teach them how a system must organize itself politically and socially such that physical and chemical research take place. It is not enough for us to educate African boys and girls in science and technology so that Africans can catch up with the Europeans. You will never catch up with the European just by knowing science and technology. Because, ladies and gentlemen, you have to finance technological research. You have to pay scientists to do research. People just don't do research for nothing. If you run the latest physics experiment, you would have to produce a cyclotron with a circumference of some 20 or 30 miles around that costs billions of dollars. And if you're then talking about catching up with the European scientifically, then you must catch up with the European and surpass him, what? Economically. If your children are to work for you and give their scientific genius to the advancement of black people, then we as black people must give them an economic, social, and political foundation in which their gifts can be realized and handed over to us as a people. And therefore, merely to teach chemistry and physics as some neutral subject, as some body of knowledge unrelated to everything else going on into the world, is to be miseducated. That is one of the reasons why we have a country filled, as black people, with chemists, with engineers, machinists, and yet we don't seem to be able to export one gun to South Africa. We don't seem to be able to make one bomb. We have generals and sergeants and green berets and rangers and all of the rest, and yet we are unable to train one guerrilla or anything else to fight for their liberation in this world because there's a lack of social organization. It is not enough just to have knowledge. It is not enough just to have money. Money and knowledge must be organized in order to be effective. And knowledge, in order to flourish and be actualized in some concrete advancement for people, must be based ultimately on social relations between those people. So there must be a social structure. And while your children are learning science and mathematics, they must learn to love themselves and to love one another, and to cooperate one with the other. Or else they'll have an Afrocentric mind, but they will still have to go down to IBM and Xerox and do their work. And ultimately then, they will still be racked by a sense of inferiority and dependency. So we must keep that in mind. Let me quickly state here then that the sense of inferiority in black people and the other problems we talk about will not be removed by assimilation. They will not be removed by integration. They will not be removed by Jesse Jackson being elected president of the United States. They will not be removed by the election of other black politicians. And that doesn't say that Jesse Jackson shouldn't be elected, and it doesn't say that other politicians should not be elected. I'm saying, though, we cannot look at those things as being the sole basis for removing and solving the kinds of problems that we have. Because maladjustment is not merely a malady of the individual personality. Maladjustment is functional for a system. That system sometimes can be a family. Do you know sometimes A family is held together by a sick person. It is a scapegoat, a quote-unquote black sheep, around which the family defines itself. Sometimes a husband and wife keep the relationship because one of them is sick. And when one goes to the psychiatrist somewhere and try to get better, decide that they're going to change their life, the relationship breaks up. And often families will subtly pull a member back into alcoholism and other kinds of problems as a way of maintaining itself, even though it may be claiming aloud that it's really concerned with getting the person well. Because often the sickness of one individual works to the advantage of another one. And I will say then, when you see a society producing a lot of illness, the illness must be functional for that society. The sick people must be playing a very valuable role in that system. In other words, people don't drive you crazy for nothing. There's some benefit involved. Let me read this section then. The question that often goes unasked or unanswered from a general theoretical point of view is one that's asked, what familial societal role is played by the maladjusted personality? Why are we sick and why do we have the inferiority complex that we have as people? If the maladjusted personality is created and maintained by a social system, whether that system be dyadic, that is a system where there's a relationship between two people, familial or society, then it is reasonable to assume that such a personality, that is the maladjusted personality, is created and maintained because it is needed, because it is essential to the functioning of that system or some segment of that system. The maladjusted personality is created and maintained in service to another. I've often said, of course, one of the problems we have as people is that we are a created people. We are a creation of the Eurocentric Dr. Frankenstein. And we have been created to serve the purpose of Europeans. One of the major goals of an Afrocentric education and of Afrocentric development is that we become self-developed people, that we determine what our personality traits will be, that we determine our destiny and our direction, and not be determined by our reactionary relationship to some other people. Often a maladjusted personality is created and maintained in service to parental and familial self-image, to societal, economic, political values and goals. If the maladjusted personality is a defensive and avoidant one, and such defensive and avoidant tendencies are deemed neurotic, then they are created to defend the individual against neurotic demands and to help him avoid a reality that is painful. However, that doesn't mean that the individual is not engaged also in serving the society. Often we look at a neurotic person as a defensive personality, as a personality that is avoidant, it seeks to avoid certain responsibilities and certain reactions and certain realities. We must also see, though, that personality in defending itself, in avoiding certain realities, actually serves another group or another person. I was doing a lecture here on self-hatred. And in the very first lecture, I dealt with the image of the blonde, blue-eyed Jesus. And I made the statement that you had to beware of a church such that when you walk into it, the first thing you see is a blonde, blue-eyed Jesus back behind the altar. That church is lying to you. And that church is going to help send you to hell. How did I say that? Because first of all, there's nowhere in the Bible that a description of that Jesus has ever been given. And secondly, that Bible strictly states that graven images should not be made. And it's done. And one minister jumped up, offended because of that statement. and took the statement personally. And I'm a minister in the such and such a church, and I took a course under Dr. Cone at Columbia University, and, you know, just laid it all out for me, you know, and objected to it as if I were attacking the minister directly when I was dealing with the concept, and I was dealing with the psychology of having gods painted in alien forms. And how that induces self-hatred and maintains self-hatred in the people. How praying to a white man is damaging to black people. And how thinking of God as a white man is damaging to black people. I'm dealing with the concept here. Yet she felt a need to defend what she thought of as herself and her profession. But in defending herself, she actually defended the system. She actually defended the status quo. And many of us then, as neurotics, you see, as we engage in our neurotic and maladjusted behavior and defend our egos and defend our vanities and defend our pride, actually support and hold up the system. It's imperative or justify the abusing family. And how we, in many instances, end up justifying a system that abuses us. Integration itself indicates that, wanting to live and be loved and lay around with people who destroyed us and enslaved us and given us the greatest pain in the world. So that's what we call in psychology the love of the aggressor. The people you want to love most are the people who've done the most damage to you. Unhealthy personalities cannot be created by healthy environments. Since the unhealth of an individual or group can result in the relative health, wealth, security, and power and sense of identity of another individual or group, then it serves the interest of the latter group. In other words, the unhealth of the black community serves the health and wealth of the white community. Just as the sickness of the drug addict serves the health and wealth of the pusher. So in a sense then, it becomes in the interest of the pusher to keep the addict, of course, addicted, even though he claims he's doing him a service and a favor. The latter group becomes dependent, that is the unhealthy group, comes to need the unhealthiness, and that is the dominant group, really becomes dependent and comes to need the unhealthiness of the former. If the health of the former means a reduction in the dominance of the latter, then the latter resists the health of the former despite its pretensions to the contrary. In other words, when we even see assimilationism, we don't have time to talk about it here tonight, but in many ways assimilationism and integrationism is really another prompt for the maintenance of white power. And while we thought that we bought it in to a great extent, I would argue that to a good extent the white ruling class helped to push it as well, because it also helps to maintain the white ruling class in power. When you have a minority of people, such as the European, often in order to stay in power they must recruit from the very people they oppress. And therefore they will call up from those people certain talented people or other types who then will identify with their masters and helped them to maintain the control over the masses. This often will be called integration and will often be called desegregation. But ultimately, if you look very closely, you notice one thing, that the real power relationship between those two groups has not changed. I talk about a number of things we call constants, that if we look closely in the relationship, at the relationship between Europeans and Africans, we will note that there are certain basic things that have not changed despite all of the other things we look at. Despite integrationism, despite political and social change, there are things that are still basically the same and have been the same for the last 400 years. The real power of black people, particularly if you talk about military power, has not changed fundamentally since the very time we met the European. You may find African countries now with jet planes and tanks that they bought from Europeans, by the way, and still have yet to make. And you may think then that the Africans have entered into a modern era in warfare and so forth. But I would dare say that there's not a single African country that could really protect the interests of black people against European power, particularly as that power moves out into space and can rain down on the African continent bombs and laser weapons and other weapons of various types. And African countries having no anti-ballistic system, no Star Wars system, no system to fight war in space is literally defenseless. And yet they may fly the latest American jets, and in the face of American and European war power, we are still ultimately defenseless. That has not changed fundamentally in 400 years, ladies and gentlemen. The European economic control of this globe fundamentally has not changed either. The European control of information has not changed fundamentally either. The European control of definition, the definition of reality, the definition of what is and is not, has not changed fundamentally either. That has been the case for a long time. The European tendency to degrade things African has not changed as well. You may now have a degree in computer technology. You may now have a job that pays you $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 a year, but your fundamental relationship to the European has not changed one whit from the fundamental relationship between our African forefathers and his European slave master. For as you work your computers, you still work to the profit of Europeans. And so the fact that we've moved into the executive offices does not mean we've moved into power. Does not mean that the fundamental power relationship between Europeans and Africans have changed one bit. As a matter of fact, the moving of blacks into the executive offices is an effort to maintain that power and to obscure that power behind a form of neocolonialism. I don't think it is an accident that the desegregation movement and the assimilationist movement in America parallel the neocolonial movement in Africa. As I often tell my classes, you as black students are now being educated to put a black face on white power and to help deceive your people into thinking because you got a job, we have moved forward as a people. Let's then just take a quick look at the functions of maladjustment and why you cannot get blacks, why it is important that blacks never get out of their sickness. You ever wondered why the more social workers you produce, the crazier people get? The more psychologists you produce, the crazier people get. Do you ever wonder about that? I lost a job challenging whites about that. Why you, as a white man, whom these crazy people have permitted to be chairman of the Department of Predominantly Hispanic and Black College, why do you, as a black man, a white man, continue to try to bring these psychologists in here when you know that this psychology is not doing the black and Hispanic community one whit of good? He could not disagree with that. How do you pretend to judge the qualifications of black people for teaching other black people and Hispanic teachers and Hispanic students, when you admit every day in the New York educational system that you don't know how to educate black children? We have a group of people who lament about their inability to educate black children, how black children are so-called uncontrollable and ineducable and all of that, and yet they want to sit on a board and determine who is qualified and not qualified. We have this insult downtown where these white dogs are going to try to determine who should be the chancellor of New York City schools, and yet have admitted that they cannot educate black children. And we'll sit there and let them try to lay the foundation and tell us what the credentials of an educator is supposed to be. How do you qualify to tell us what the credentials of an educator is supposed to do? You have not demonstrated that you are capable of educating black people, but yet there are a lot of us who want to sit back and talk about standards and degrees and all this other nonsense that the people who clearly admitted that they failed have laid upon us. And yet we have a lot of this going on in the system. But this kind of stuff must happen if black people are to continue to be subordinated. How is it functional? The captive African maladjustment justifies European dominance and exploitation. Because we are crazy, because we are criminals, because we are addicts, because we are that, the Europeans have a right to put their police in our community. They have a right to run the welfare agencies that keep us crazy, by the way. They have a right to intrude into our cultural families and personal lives. Why? Because, you see, they are maladjusted. They have learning deficiencies. They have this and that. Therefore, we're coming in to help and treat them in some sort of way. We are bringing in foreign aid. We are calling on the IMF to study and regulate their national economies and so forth. So you will see the so-called sickness and dependency and lagging in development and all of these other kinds of things every day are justifications for the Europeans to intrude upon African life and seek to control that life. And when we accept their definitions, we accept their dominance. We ask for their dominance, and we see their dominance as some kind of aid to us. Yet, when we look some 40 years later, we are in the same position or in a worse position than before. How do we solve it? Asking more of it. Well, let's get more degrees. Let's see that the teachers get more degrees. Even though the more degrees they get, the worse the education has become. But what's the solution? Send them back to school for some more. The more money that's been pumped into school, what happens? The worse education has got. What's the solution? Let's put more money into school. Idiotic solutions all over the place. But you see, you cannot expect a neurotic to think normally. That's the essence of being what? Neurotic. If you thought normally, behaved normally, you wouldn't be a neurotic, would you? So being maladjusted justifies European dominance, rationalizes Eurocentric treatment, as I just said, of African people, and thereby reduces their guilt and self-condemnatory feelings for behaving toward the African in ways contrary to their stated political and constitutional, ethical, moral, religious principles. You know, these great Christians and these great people who believe in equality. How do you believe in equality? You know, the greatest problem in this country was, how do you believe in equality of man and yet enslave a group of men? How do you believe in this and mistreat and discriminate? In order to get out of that dilemma, then, you must make those people what? Less than men. Less than human. You see? So then in that way you can justify what you do. They're not fully human. They're not fully men. They're not fully intelligent. They're not fully capable of self-government. They're not fully capable of guiding themselves. Therefore, it's only incumbent on us, those of us who are lucky enough to be more intelligent and divinely sent to rule over men, to take care of them. It is incumbent upon us to take up what? The white man's burden, which happens to be the black man. But actually, the other way around is we have to carry them as a burden. The maladjustment of black people maintains Eurocentric self-esteem, self-definition and identity, self-concept, sense of security, and control. Since the captive African's debilitated state, debased and degraded nature will not permit him to successfully overcome such dominance. The lowest European on the lowest street, skid row in this country, can always say one thing, at least I'm not black. He defines himself, and his self-esteem still rests upon the ultimate degradation of black people. So no matter how low and evil he sinks, he still has a superiority attitude toward black people. And therefore, the degradation of black people and maintaining black people in that state is important to the European sense of self-esteem and self-identity. The European more or less defines himself in contrast to the African person. Many of you have run into Europeans, and when you came to be what they did not expect to be, you've seen them unravel before your very eyes. When they could not play their accustomed role of dominance and mastery, you've seen them become unglued and unable to function, to become confused. It means then that our submission and subordination and degradation keeps them together. And therefore, it is necessary for them to maintain this degraded state in black people in order to maintain their sense of self as a people. And by maintaining us in this debate, this debased state and degraded state, they therefore maintain their security, because as long as we think neurotically and maladjustedly, then we will not be able to think in a way that will ultimately defeat them as a people and ultimately destroy them as a people. And remember, we're talking about people who are a minority in the world and yet who must protect their interests. Black maladjustment induces induces the captive African to engage in self-defeating behavior, which relieves the Eurocentric establishment of having to impose direct militaristic oppression and to blame the victim for his own predicament. We get plenty of that, of course. In other words, when you get the black maladjusted to a certain degree, he will mistreat himself. Well, look, I put libraries in your community. You just don't like to read. We have schools here. You just like to drop out for some reason. The knowledge is available to you. You just don't like it for some reason or other. It's a very slick system because it permits the European to pretend that they are liberal and open and so forth, and yet at the same time maintain themselves. And of course, I often talk about this. The European talks about freedom of speech. But we are only free to speak when our audience does not hear us. We are only free to speak when our audience is not interested. We are only free to speak when the audience really does not listen. Oh, I can sit here and call Reagan all kind of names and talk about white folk. That illustrates what a great system we have here. But how is this possible? To a good extent, it's possible because, you see, at first you induce the audience not to be what? Interested, not to care or to be apathetic, and then you just let the person...
By the U.S. House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate. And despite all of that and all of the fallout from that, he has not blinked. He has not wavered. He has not taken one single step in a backwards direction. You all know who I'm talking about. You've come out here tonight to greet him, to show support for him, to demonstrate your love for Dr. Khalid Abdul Muhammad. Dr. Khalid.
All right, brother. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, turn it up. All praise is due to Allah, the Lord of all the worlds. We forever give thanks and praise to Almighty God for coming, as it was written in the sacred scriptures, that he would come to seek and to save that which was lost. And we can find no other people fitting the description of the lost brother, the lost sister, or the lost sheep, except we, the 50 million or more, mentally and spiritually dead, black men and black women here in the hells of North America. And so we thank him for coming in the person of Master Farad Muhammad, and for raising up his messenger and his Messiah to the black man and black woman here in the hells of North America and throughout the world. I speak of none other than the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And in the name of the man who is my spiritual father, who is my teacher, and who has been my mentor, and who is responsible largely for my spiritual rites of passage, I speak of none other than the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. In their names, I greet you with the greeting words of peace. Assalamu alaikum. Hotep. Shalom. Shia Lafia Ni. And black laws for all black people. Free the land. And for others, what's up? It's indeed my honor to be black again at this great forum of the United African Movement, spearheaded by the dynamic and divine leadership of one who is tireless and relentless in our midst, and one who is well acquainted with controversy, well acquainted with adversity, well acquainted with injustice, well acquainted with the oppression and the attempted repression of the enemy, but one who will not bow down and will not be bought, Attorney Alton Maddox. My subject this evening, I will cover many topics under this subject, but with us standing on the threshold of the national election. It was 30 years ago that Minister Malcolm X, the great and dynamic national spokesman for the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad, in his message to the grassroots, he spoke to the grassroots of our people. And tonight I want to speak to the grassroots, to those who are in the dirt, those who are in the muck and the mire and the mud of the white man's world. 30 years ago, Malcolm said it was a case of the chickens coming home to roost. And tonight I want to tell you that 30 years later, it's a case of the chickens coming home to roost. Malcolm's subject 30 years ago on the threshold of a national election was the ballot or the bullet. And my subject 30 years later on the threshold of a national election is the bullet or the bullet. That's my subject here tonight. The bullet or the bullet. You don't have no other choice. Some of you are waiting around. You were glued to the television screen watching these two no-good crackers debate just a few nights ago. And you are trying to make up your mind which peck of wood you're going to vote for. This is the year of the bullet or the bullet. You don't have no choice. One cracker named Bill Clinton, nicknamed Slick Willie. Would you buy a used car from a cracker named Slick Willie? An adulterer. Huh? Doesn't even live up to the standards of his own nation. A draft dodger. A dope head. A cracker who gets high and then wants to fool you and hoodwink you and tell you, I didn't inhale. A dope head an adulterer, and one who doesn't even follow the standards of his own people, a draft dodger, Slick Willie, lied to you 4 years ago, still lying to you 4 years later, and another cracker, an old wrinkled, crippled, crazy cracker, cracker with a funny hand, shaking people's hand with his left hand. And you tell me I'm voting for this cracker, some of you for president, and the damn peckerwood can't even stay on the stage. The cracker fell off the goddamn stage. fell out in the audience. Can you imagine you're supposed to get off of Air Force One and salute the Marine Corps and salute the honor guard when you step off the plane? Now, what will this cracker do with this funny hand? What is he going to do? Get off the plane and try to throw up a salute with that funny hand? Some of you say, why be so personal? Why not attack the man's policy? Why not attack the platform that the man stands on? Don't deal with the man's personal life. Don't deal with him. Deal with this policy. Well, I'm a military scientist. And in military science and military strategy, you don't just attack the tank. You attack the fueling depot that the tank depends on. You don't just attack the train. You attack the track that the train runs on. You don't just try to deal with the cracker once the plane, the bomber plane is in the air. You attack that which is responsible for giving the plane what is necessary in its power and energy to lift up off the ground. And so I attack the cracker too, and his policy. You talking about civil rights. Ain't no damn civil rights. The cracker ain't never been civil, and he ain't never been right. You talking about, well, what about human rights? The cracker ain't human and he ain't never been right. It's the year of the bullet or the bullet. You either deal or die. You either fight back or get destroyed. You either get on the right side or it's genocide. It's the year of the bullet or the bullet. You've been voting for crackers ever since they allowed you to vote. And tonight we want to cover some of the history here. The history teaches us that from 1870 to 1901, blacks served in the various states as congressmen and sat in every Congress from the 41st to the 56th, with one exception. Says they were brilliant men. They were great orators. In fact, during the period of Reconstruction, we were mayors, we were sheriffs, we were senators, we were congressmen, and even B.K. Bruce was in the Treasury Department, and his signature was on all paper money in America. No matter how racist a cracker was, a big pot belly, beer billy, snuff dipping, tobacco chewing, straw chewing, overall wearing peckerwood, no matter how much he hated niggers, he had to handle currency and money that had the signature of a black man in the Treasury Department on it. What is my point? During Reconstruction, it looked like a period of political prosperity. It looked like we were going to make it. As the historians say, we had good jobs working for ourselves. Many of us had good farmland. We were making what was called good money, and we were in high positions. But when the white man decided that he was through with niggas being in political office. Then no matter how many elected positions we had, no matter how much money we had, no matter how much land we had, no matter what we had, the white man stood in the door of Congress, and they were armed in the door of Congress, and they said, no more nigger senators coming through these doors. They went to the floor of the Senate and the Congress and stood in the door armed to make sure that we didn't enter those what they call portals of the government of the United States of America. They went to the sheriff's office. Crackers stood armed, shotguns, pistols, big beer belly peckerwoods, standing outside. And the black sheriff showed up at the sheriff's office. He was elected by the people. But when the black sheriff showed up at the sheriff's office, crackers armed and cocked their guns on him, and all you could hear was the staccato of the cocking of their weapons on him, saying, nigga, you're not the sheriff no more. We got a new sheriff in town. Big Bubba here. Big Bubba's the sheriff, not nigga. He said, but I was duly elected by the people. They said, nigga, you better get on with this, nigga. Or Big Bubba here gonna rescue, nigga. You ain't the sheriff here no more, nigga. We taking the law back into our own hands, nigga. It looked like a period of political prosperity. Civil Rights Act. Voter Rights Act. Johnson sitting down penning the Civil Rights Act of 1964. If the Civil Rights Act was worth what was written on the paper, then Martin Luther King and those who would come after him would not have to fight so hard if it had meant anything. If the Voting Rights Bill had meant anything during Reconstruction, then Fannie Lou Hamer and others wouldn't have had to fight so hard coming behind the Voting Rights Bill. What am I saying here tonight? I'm taking an unpopular position, which is not new for me. I'm saying that separation is the best and only solution. I'm saying, as a reminder to you, that we must have a nation of our own. Because every time we vote together in a solid block, I know what Malcolm said to you 30 years ago. And all the great that Malcolm did, Malcolm was feeling. Malcolm was studying and searching and digging and researching and finding himself. And so Malcolm said, in such matters, vote in a solid block. He talked about the Democrat and the Dixiecrat. He talked about, stop talking about the South, he said. Anytime you're south of the Canadian border, Malcolm said, you're in the South. Malcolm said, it's no democracy, nothing but disguised hypocrisy. No American dream, nothing but an American nightmare. The Supreme Court has passed down new rulings now in various states across the country, striking down what is called majority-minority voting districts. Striking down majority-minority voting districts. What does that mean? It means a district that has a great population of black people who have gone out and registered to vote and who believe that they have real power because they've registered to vote. Let me stop for a minute. I am proud to say that I am not registered to vote. I have never voted. And when a strong black candidate comes along, and I'm going to talk about that a little bit tonight, a black candidate who is not afraid of the white man, a black candidate who comes in the mold of Adam Clayton Powell Jr., a black candidate who has sat at the feet of Adam Clayton Powell Jr. If a bold black candidate comes along, then the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad says such candidates should have the total backing of the black nation, that all of us should get behind such a candidate as that. But to get behind some glorified shower curtains and pull a lever for one cracker over another cracker, another Pinocchio-eared cracker named Perot. Here's a cracker that has lied so much his nose won't grow, his damn ears grow. Who are the candidates? Satan, the devil, Lucifer, and with Buchanan running, Buchanan, that's who he is, Satan, the devil, Lucifer, and Beelzebub. And either one you vote for, you're going to still end up catching hell. The Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad never told us to vote for a white man. He said we should find the right qualifications in a black candidate. One again who is not afraid of the white man and who will stand up for reparations and who will stand up for the freedom and independence of our people and will not back down from the white man. Got Negroes in this town talking about backing the white man over a black man. A black man who anytime you're in trouble, sometimes he's there before the police get there. Sometimes there before the ambulance gets there. But you got a Negro in this town named Butts. You should know you can't trust a nigga named Butts. How you gonna trust a nigga named Butts? That's our problem now. We've been sitting on our butts too long. If my name was Butts, I would go out tonight and change my name overnight. How are you going to get respect telling people that your name is Butts? And then you take a behind position every time an issue comes up. Negro ran out and attacked the rappers. Let me put the bullet on hold for a moment. Went out and attacked the rappers. He didn't know Tupac Shakur. You don't know Snoop Doggy Dogg. You don't know Biggie Smalls. You don't know Sean Puffy Combs. You don't know them Butts. While you sitting on your butt, afraid to come into the community and deal with the grassroots of your people, a whole generation has come up around you. Let's talk about the rappers for a minute. Can we talk about the rappers for a moment? Let's talk about Tupac Shakur for a moment. Tupac Shakur is a child of the 60s. Tupac Shakur, born out of the spirit of the revolution of the 60s. Tupac Shakur, fire in his bones. Huh? Boldness and rebellion in his blood. Born from his beautiful, bold Black Panther mama, Afeni. Sitting in the jail cell, a revolutionary woman carrying the fruit of life, mocking the child in her womb, mocking the child with rebellion, mocking the child with insurrection, mocking the child with a spirit to not go along with what's been going on. When you got a generation like that, you've got to work with them. You've got to mold them and shape them and fashion them. They represent the best generation we've ever produced. They're mad. They're angry. White man say, "Where your cap turn this way?" They turn theirs around. He say he wearing his pants up, they wear theirs down. Whatever he says do, they do the opposite. Rebellious. Sick and tired of what's been going on in the hells of North America. And so they rap lyrics that speak to the pain and the suffering and the low-down life of the black man and woman. They speak to our condition at the grassroots level, in the muck, in the mire, and in the mud. Not to just be attacked. If you sit and if you stand in the pulpit that Adam Clayton Powell Jr. stood in, Adam Clayton Powell characterized himself in his words as the baddest nigger in Congress. The baddest nigger in Congress. That's what he said. He said, "Keep the faith, baby. Don't panic." Tupac said the same thing. Keep your head up. Keep your head up. But for butts and a few other butt-licking, boot-licking, buck-dancing niggas, somebody has to call these niggas out. But some of you are so connected to them, or you want something from them, or you want favor from them, or you want to be recognized by them. If you don't stand up for the liberation of our people, then to hell with any nigga. I don't care who he is or where he is, to hell with him if he won't stand up for the liberation of our people. If we touch the hearts and minds of the rappers, they could create a revolution overnight. Overnight. Literally, overnight. But to attack them and put them down, talking about the language that they use, when you're acting like what they're talking about. But to the youth who are under the sound of my voice, you too have a responsibility. You do have a responsibility to wake up, clean up, and stand up. And give liberation lyrics to our people that will uplift them and not degrade them and put them down. Because if we follow the same filth of the white man's world, then our world will go down under the weight of filth and corruption, the same way the white man's world is going down. And so to our young brothers and sisters, don't try to pattern your life. You're criticizing the butts and the other toms. But at the same time, you're trying to be like the Italian gangsters. You gangster rap. You dress like Al Capone. You dress like some other cracker, some Jew gangster, some Italian gangster. You're not a gangster. You are the very people of God, trying to look like some damn criminal from Italy, some mafioso, some Italiano boy. Look like fools on TV, dressed up in all of this mess. You diss black designers. You don't want to wear the clothes from your black designer. You wearing Tommy Hill, nigga. You wearing polo. Because you've been so damn poor and you've been living so damn low until you don't want to do nothing to pick yourself up and do something for yourself and give proper direction and guidance to the masses of your people who yearn to breathe free. This is the year of the bullet or the bullet. You ain't got a whole lot of more years to keep going over and over, round and round with this same thing, trying to decide on which peck of wood is going to be the lesser of two evils. I talked to a Muslim brother today from the Nation of Islam who was telling me that he was going to vote for Clinton. He said Clinton was the lesser of the two evils. Said he voted for Cuomo because he was the lesser of two evils of Pataki. I said, brother, we ain't got to vote for either one of them. What happened to the days of freedom and independence? What about a nation of our own? What about the call of black nationalism? What about the spirit when we were pushing to build for ourselves? You don't even dream like that anymore. Muslim talking about voting for some cracker. You gonna put some agenda before some cracker and decide which one is gonna do the most for black people. Come on. The Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad said on this subject, and it should be guidance for us. He said, put the Muslim program before Congress. It is difficult for me. It is what? It's what? It is difficult for me to advise my followers on taking part in the corrupt politics of our enemies who are in complete control of the political affairs. Who are in complete control of the political affairs. Did he say they were partially in control? He said they were in complete control. That's why when you say we're going to vote in a solid block and they see you have some black voting power, then from the highest court in the white land, the Supreme Court, as I mentioned earlier, they send down a law or a decree that says we got to bust up this solid block voting. Can't send your own candidate who will represent your own interests and who will speak to your own needs and work for you. They bust up those districts. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad said a white man is in complete control of the political affairs. There are 100 senators in America. Is that right? How many of them do we have? One, and she's questionable. Carol Moseley Braun. She's one of the Negroes that voted against me in the Senate, and a whole bunch of Negroes in the Congress. That Maxine Waters stood up tall and strong. I saw her at a black festival in California, and she ran to me and hugged me. She said, you're getting on up there now when you got them talking about you all up in Congress and everywhere. She said, you didn't think I was going to vote against you, did you? She didn't vote against me. I listened to that black woman dealing with them crackers on television last night about the CIA dumping this dope in the black community. Maxine Waters stood up toe-to-toe with them crackers. In fact, after a moment, she put the House of Representatives stuff to the side. She said, you lying. Just told the cracker straight up. She didn't say, I want to tell the gentleman from Illinois, the gentleman from Maryland, that he's prevaricating. She said, you lying. Straight up. Said it more than once. I said, now this sister's all right. She represents South Central. You need a representative like Maxine Waters who will go and face these crackers and deal with these crackers. I heard Reverend Sharpton is running for mayor. How in the hell could you vote for a cracker if Reverend Sharpton is running for mayor? You're out of your goddamn mind. You had another Negro right here in Brooklyn. Supposed to be a black nationalist, Sonny Carson. See, you Negroes scared. The ones who said that. got out on the radio saying he's going to Reverend Sharpton's house if he runs. Like he gonna protest in the man's yard. And he didn't want Reverend Sharpton to run for mayor. What kind of Negro is that? He said, well, we got some problems with Reverend Sharpton. Nigga, you ain't got no problems with Giuliani? You see, I ain't connected to none of you. I want to be connected to all of you. But my stand is a principled stand. If you stand firm and right, I'm with you. If you are against Sharpton running for mayor, if you have something against Sharpton running for mayor, then you should have just kept your damn mouth shut and stayed on the sidelines some damn way. Now, if he was running against some black candidates and you felt that the black candidates were better candidates, one of them was better than Sharpton, Reverend Sharpton, I can understand that. But as far as I know, the field is full of crackers. And public enemy number one is Giuliani. Or put niggas behind bars in the electric chair, in the gas chamber, lethal injection, state prosecutor Peckerwood. Giuliani, you're not for Sharpton. Keep your damn mouth shut. White folks look at you like a damn fool. They laugh at you. They think that something is wrong with you. If you're not for the only black candidate that's running, just be quiet, sissy. Vainglorious. Put the Muslim program of reparations and separation before Congress. He says there are many black men and women who make splendid politicians. They could accomplish considerable good if they, like the white politician and his people, were given proper and equal recognition and justice for themselves and their people. If our politicians are to serve us, they must have no fear of the white man. When they plead our case in the white courts before white judges, the strongest politician of our kind at that time, or the person who comes nearest, as far as I know, to giving us political justice in the white courts, if he had our complete backing, is Congressman Adam Clayton Powell, Jr. This is a message to the black man by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. Though he is not a Muslim, a Muslim politician is what you need. Let's stop for a moment. It's got to be the right Muslim politician. If you don't want no Muslim politician, it's going to get in there buck dancing, shuffling and scratching. They got Muslim politicians all over America today. Shuffling and scratching and boot licking and buck dancing. Thank you, baby. With the white man. So the Honorable Elijah Muhammad meant a real Muslim. He meant a righteous Muslim. It's a shame we have to qualify Muslim. Muslim is supposed to mean all of that anyway. But this devil got a lot of power. But Congressman Powell is not afraid and would not be easily bribed, for he is not hungry. There are two other good politicians, but I will not mention them by name at this time. If they could shed their fear, Honorable Elijah Muhammad said they were scared, whoever they were, they would make excellent political leaders to guard our interests. We must give good black politicians the total backing of our population. Did he say good white politicians? Why can't you trust a so-called good white politician? You see, there are no good white folks and bad white folks. It's just two kinds of white folks. Bad white folks and worse white folks. That's the only two kinds of white folks you can find anywhere. He said, we must give good black politicians the total backing of our population. Your program, the one I have given you, which is carried in the first part of this chapter, should be put before Congress. The Civil Rights Bill and integration will not stand and can never bring independence to you and your people, no matter who is president. Black or white, the Civil Rights Bill and integration, the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad said, could never bring us freedom and independence. Don't make no difference who the candidate is, again, black nor white. It could never bring us freedom and independence. So today we have to look for good black candidates. I've never voted. But if the right candidate comes along, I'll swing my support behind that candidate. Even though I don't believe in the political process of the white man at all. I don't care whether you like me for that or not. The politics of the white man is insipid. The politics of the white man is rotten to the core. The politics of the white man could never solve our problem. It's like a poison white cake. You can put black chocolate icing on top of the poison white cake, but it's still poison down to the smallest morsel. And it was baked in the oven of the White House for white folks, in a government of white people, by white people, and for white people. White man never intended for his nigga to be no political power over him. Every time you position yourself, he will change the rules on you. Every time you look like you maneuvering in place, we got affirmative action, you say. We got food stamps, you say. We got entitlements, you say. Some of you turned into big niggas smoking big cigars because your big nigga company made you walk around over the rest of your people looking down at them, condescending, because you had Section 8 set aside. Then they put a nigga up on the Supreme Court to vote with the white folk. Nigga named Clarence Thomas. You know that Negro. Married to that big old dinosaur looking white woman. Go home to that white woman and look like Jurassic Park. Nigga got to get up in a stepladder just to get some sugar from that big pack of wood. Why do you do that? Marry the biggest pack of wood you can find. That's a big old white woman. Clarence,